This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
The doctor is in with me, Dr. Janotha Archer Cartwright. I'm a family medicine specialist, and I'm here with you to talk about all things health, wellness, and things that pertain to the Bahamian society. Our topic is somewhat mixed tonight. It's definitely looking at health through the angle of a more social topic, but I think it's really interesting knowing the climate of what's happening today and just kind of looking at what's happening all around us in life, in the Bahamas, in the world, and just what we each are experiencing. So I really think this is going to be interesting tonight. I hope you guys really enjoy it, and I want you guys to get involved. So I'm going to open the lines fairly early, okay, such that we can definitely take some calls if you want to jump into the conversation at all. And so I'm going to give out the phone lines fairly early so that people can participate from that part of it. And so the phone lines tonight, 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. So that's 323-6232, 325-4316, and 325-4259. I mean, you can kind of open if you want to talk about other things as well. But of course, just to remind you guys, brought to you by Medical Concierge Services, all your medical health care need. We are a family medicine clinic at the Bahamas Heart Center. We do a variety of things, child immunizations, right up to adult illnesses, chronic disease management. Of course, we do home care. We specialize in coming to you, so you can give us a call, as well as IV vitamin therapy, microneedling, so many different things. So check out our website, mcsfamilymedicine.com, and you can give us a call at 326-1521. If you need to catch us on WhatsApp or you need to sign up for NHI, you're going to give us a text on our WhatsApp line, 432-4010. We are live tonight on Guardian Radio. We're also on Facebook, so you can check out my page on Facebook, which is The Doctor's In With Me, Dr. D. Archer. And you can see us live on Facebook, the Guardian Radio app, and a bunch of other places. So tonight, I really wanted to talk about the cost of living and how is that affecting us, what's happening in the world. We've gone through so many things, and we're seeing that the cost of living is really, really gone up quite a bit. And how is that related to our health? Well, health is definitely related to wealth, and the amount of money that you have is a really interesting point. And so I found some really interesting conversations and articles about this that I thought were like really good conversation and stuff that we should really think about, right? So we know that there is a correlation between health and wealth, and there's been lots of different studies and stuff that have gone about really getting into that. And so we have to think about that because, you know, we might think that money doesn't matter, and that, you know, there's just like, you know, you don't need to have a certain amount of money, but you really kind of do. And so I'm going to start with this kind of article I saw from One Op, Readiness, Knowledge, and Network. And it talks about the correlation between health and wellness and wealth altogether. And so this article by Molly C. Herden talks about the fact that there have been multiple studies which show a positive correlation between good health and higher income. And that is, people who earn more money tend to have less disease and better health overall. Poor health and higher rates of disease are associated with more with the lower economic groups. And so those living in low income households are less likely to have health insurance, they're less likely to have access to medication, treatments that can be, that they can use for chronic health disease. You know, sometimes I have to do some cost analysis when I'm dealing with patients in terms of the cost of medication and what they could afford. And that's becoming a really prevailing thing as time goes by and, you know, your money kind of stays the same and the cost of living goes up. So low income families also have less access to preventative care and specialty care. And even here we do have a lot of things, we've got NHI and different stuff. You still have the cost of healthcare being extremely expensive, especially in a country where there is a lot of chronic disease happening. All right. Even mental health has been found to be affected by income, with families earning less than $35,000 in the U.S. And I would compare us to them because I think it's relatively similar in terms of if you think about like how much we make, but then we don't have the same tax rates that they have and then the quality of living, that kind of stuff. So for people, families making less than $35,000 in the U.S., there were reports of nervousness at least four times more often than families that made over $100,000 a year. So just the whole aspect of anxiety and worry and depression and all of those things are just more relevant when the income is limited. One of the most striking statistics that they found was around health and wealth was related to life expectancy. And what they found that in the 1970s, those in the higher end tax bracket had a life expectancy increase of over 6 years, whilst those in the lower tax brackets only had an increase of 1.3. So all of this modern medicine, you know, being able, new technology, all of that stuff really had more of an impact in people who had the money to afford and access some of these things. In fact, a study found that citizens living just 350 miles apart in the same U.S. cities had drastically different life expectancies. What they found in West Virginia was men can expect to live up to the age of 64. And in Fairfax, Virginia, men were living up to the age of 82. So such a really large difference in life expectancy just based on the economic regions within that same city, state. So it wasn't a surprise that individuals with higher income can afford to go to the gym, gym memberships, although you can run outside is for free, but I'm just talking about access, have more time for improving their physical health, have higher paying careers, are also likely to be provided more comprehensive health insurance, and getting access to nutritional food. And we know that the cost of food is something that we all talk about. I went to the food store multiple times this month. I'm sure we're spending over $1,000 on grocery, or I guess four people and a toddler, five people altogether. And so the cost of food, just going to the food store, this isn't even like going out or anything like that. Definitely, it is very, very costly. And if you're trying to eat healthy foods, it makes it extremely difficult to get to the nutritious food that you really, really need. Although I advocate that we do grow our own food, many people just don't have access to that either. So it's like the high cost of really, really good nutritious food, not having the access of growing your own food, and it becomes a difficult situation. So nutritious food, fresh fruits and vegetables cost more than calorie-dense, inexpensive, ready-to-eat meals. And so all of this, you know, creates this kind of gap in health. Now, in America, they touch on this subject of race being a difference. I think the dynamics of race is very different here in the Bahamas, since most of our population is of African descent, I guess, in a sense. And then we have a bit of blending throughout, and then we do have Caucasians, but, you know, it's quite a different dynamics. And then I think economics really, at the end of the day, is a bigger separator of people than race, which is, you know, can even be subjective. The studies they looked at also looked at research about how poverty and lack of finances affect children and their health. And what they found is that research found that the effects of poverty and how it impacts children, those effects lasted well into their adult lives. And it could impact their future generations as well. For example, children who grow up experiencing adverse child events are more likely to smoke as adults. Among the compounding generational effects of poverty, researchers also point to education. Children living in poverty are less likely to complete college than children of a higher income parents, and also creating an educational gap. Well, I looked at that, and I was going to get into that deeply, but going to college, not as much of a divider than you would think. It's really the fact that if kids are able to finish high school, actually. So college does give people an opportunity to create beyond being middle class, but going into the streams of wealth. But it just getting out of high school tends to at least be able to bring you to the middle class, which we'll discuss a little bit later. So 70% of minors in the United States were found to be obese, which had lasting health impacts into their adulthood, including high blood pressure, diabetes, and psychosocial problems. Low-income children were more likely to be obese than those from a higher income bracket, and educational level of the parents is also negatively associated with the obesity of the children. And so we found that, you know, having less money, less education, all of this created kind of a nest for unhealthy lifestyles that affect the children and kind of follow them throughout their life. And I've said this to a lot of parents as they walk in, like first thing in the morning when I worked some of the clinics, you know, like kids are drinking juice and eating chips and stuff like that. And you tend to find those, like they call them, dense calorie rich foods in lower income brackets. But even just educational wise, knowing that it's not good for children, this is why it's important for us to have these type of conversations, because we are affecting their long-term ability of improving their health. By the age of two, most children have created all the fat cells they're going to have in their body. So if you are pumping a kid at 2 years old filled with stuff that's not good for them, you know, and they're going to be a really big five-year-old, and then eventually they're going to be a really big adult, and you would be setting up that child for problems in the future. But what the article is kind of pointing to is that a lot of these choices, a lot of these things are based on the fact that the economic ability of the family in order to make the type of choices that they need is extremely difficult. So if you don't have the resources to get the food that you need, then, you know, what can you do? And this is why I like to talk about these topics sometimes, and I want to integrate social topics into health, because health touches so many different realms, and so many different realms touch health. And it's all intertwined, and we do have to start looking at our problems in a more multidisciplinary manner. The article goes on to talk about solutions to the problem. They did a report in 2017 and found that early childhood programs focused on early care, education, and parent education had positive impacts on the emotional being and cognitive achievements and health of the children. Other studies showed that positive outcomes are associated with programs designed to give families housing and stability. And in one study, people who were moved out of a low poverty neighborhood were found to earn higher salaries as adults. The study found that those who were moved earned 31% more annually than their peers who stayed in those high poverty areas. And so that was kind of the beginning of this whole conversation on how that affects. Now, I think I want to, there's another correlation paper that I would like to go through, but I want to go to an article that was written in The Guardian that I have here somewhere. It was by India James. But it talks about the increase that's happening. Maybe I don't have it here, but there's a lot of things like, you know, being increased over time. There's a discussion on NIB being increased and what would that mean over time. I did see like a really, I was listening to the radio and I heard them talking about having these hikes to NIB over the next few years and saying that you need to increase it by 1.5% over, you know, multiple times. And, you know, when I, you know, we hear these things, but I barely ever hear any opposition or any kind of debate or discussion about these things. It's like everybody is so subdued in their own worlds, I guess, that things are just happening, right? So the government approves NIB rate hike, increase expected effect in July. Now, we know this has been pushed back, but I just wanted to go over this article because as far as I see, that increase is coming, and they're actually putting it into play that this is going to be have to be done multiple times. And I'm just thinking, how do we survive in this country where we, you know, where we're facing increase this idea of increasing taxes continually? We're not getting anything really back as Bahamians for it, you know, here and there. But we're not seeing all the way that where our money is going. People need to keep more income for themselves so that they can provide for their families. And, you know, is it the best idea to pump more money into a system that may need, you know, to be fixed? So the article was talking about the NIB increase. This is actually back in February. And they talked about how the government announced a 1.5% increase and that the Minister of State in the Office of the Prime Minister, Miles Larota, who had been responsible at NIB, didn't confirm that at the time. But we know that I think it's supposed to happen next year, even though that they wanted to happen this year. Right. They talk about that there wasn't really much of an increase since 1974. It went from 8.8 to 9.8 in 2010. But I don't think that they understand the dynamics that you're taking a portion of that person's salary. You're also taking a portion of business owners' salaries, and you're expecting somehow for these people to survive the increasing cost of living for both gas and taxi drivers just went up the other day. Global stuff has our food going up very, very often. And then you have these little increases where they're trying to tap into your money before you even get to touch it. So to me, this is almost becoming a form of income tax indirectly. And, you know, all the people involved will say like, no, you can't call it that or whatever. I'm saying how it feels, how this would feel to a person because you're tapping into their money before them. And you're talking about benefits in the future and increasing benefits for those who already benefited so far by contributing less. So to me, I don't like it. I think, you know, they really need to start finding different ways of creating revenue that doesn't involve direct taxation of Bahamian people. And there's lots of ways that they can go about that. I don't want to go into that too much, but there are so many ways that they could go about doing that. And I don't see the thought being put forward, the ingenuity, the innovation of trying to do that. You know, all of these people talk about it being lazy to just tax Bahamians, but consistently we see that this is the approach when we know that countries that are doing really well invested their money in other places and are even able to give back more to their residents and their citizens rather than getting from them. So this whole idea of taxing more and more and more, you know, it's crazy because we've survived in this world quite well without such intense taxes. And I think when you get to a point where it makes less sense for people to work than to get taxed, you know, you're bordering on having some serious problems. And I don't know how much you can tax people making small amounts of money. So they talked about that, and that's going up. And what really sparked my interest and thoughts in all of this was the fact that they talked that this would have to happen over 10 years, every 2 years. And so you're talking about getting up to a considerable amount of almost 20% taxation for a retirement fund, for, you know, something that's supposed to just help you or be a net. However, problem with it is there's access to this funds to do other things with. And I don't think that you should be able to tax us more on something mandatory like NIB if the, you know, the general government has access to that money to do with what they want to. That is very, very problematic. They talked about the fact that the report noted that NIB's annual income, which is made up of contributions and investment earnings, so I'd like to know more about those investment earnings, is insufficient to pay the annual expenditure between 2019 to 2028. So we should be investigating why that is, why the contributions and investments are not able to pay the long-term pensions, because that problem needs to be solved before you start taking more money. These are the types of questions and the type of analysis and the type of debate that we need to see from our leaders. If they can't ask these questions, then should we be giving them more money? This is a question I have in a time when the increase and the cost of living is going up. And from a physician's perspective, I see how these financial strains are affecting people, affecting their life, their healthcare, their mental health, and how they're able to take care of themselves, right? Certainly, you know, there's people out there with illnesses and treatments that they don't have the money for. Some people are really feeling, I had a pensioner tell me, you know, she couldn't afford the medication that she was on. And if there was something different that she could be on. So as a physician, I don't really want to have to go out there and learn the cost of these things, but I have to kind of learn the cost of these things to create the right combination for my patients, where I'm taking in their healthcare and what they really need, and also what that is going to cost. Because if they can't afford their medication, if they can't afford their treatment, then I'm almost kind of like not able to ensure that they're going to get the best results out of their management. And so we need to consider these things as we move along. More money out of the pockets of the average small business, more money out of the pockets of the average Bahamian. What does that mean? How does that impact us? The article goes on to talk about this, you know, more about this financial deficits, but there's no reasoning why. Why are there such deficits if everybody in the country is contributing? And I know they may have taken a substantial hit because of COVID, but it was government policy to shut everything down without looking at other reasoning on how to deal with the pandemic. So, you know, that's it may not have been this particular government, but the government as a whole made that decision to go with a solo narrative that led to a part of it. And no, most of the world went with that narrative as well. A few people were outliers, but that is a policy decision that was taken on by our leaders rather than more so a medical decision steeped in actual, you know, truth and reality and science. And so that was something that they did to themselves in a sense and did to us. As a result, the reserve is exhausted by 2028. So that's not too far away. We're in 2023, and they're saying they're going to be out of money that they've been collecting from the 1970s in the next 5 years. So immediate actions are needed to restore not only the long-term financial stability of the scheme, but most importantly, the short-term. So they're talking about short-term and long-term financial sustainability, but they're not going over the fact that why did they lose so much money? How will they counter that in the future? And how is just giving them more money going to do that? Will it just be like every government budget in which they just expand their expenses once they get more money, or they borrow more money? So we have to look at that. So the pensioners are constantly getting raises. Well, I guess they need it. But then that also means that they have to find more money every time they do this. And they have to increase benefits and all of this stuff. So they're really being kind of counterproductive in themselves. And what they need to do is get to the root problem of why this fund doesn't have the money that it should. And why isn't that money being invested in a way that it can sustain itself without major increases? Because people just can't afford it, you know? They can't afford it. And what I guess they don't understand is if people make more money, if the economy is doing better, then naturally NIB would get more money. So focus on improving the economy and, you know, making opportunities better. And taking the stranglehold that recently they've had on business owners. So the report also noticed a significant increase in the contribution rate from 9.8% to 16.9% would be required to pay full benefits. So they're going to require 16.9% split between the employer and the employee. And so that's a substantial increase. You know, it's almost double of what you would be paying now. You would be paying an NIB if they are able to increase these the payments by 2029. That's a large sum. So even let's say the employer is paying 10% and you're paying 6.9%, it's quite substantial. So every employee, you basically be paying like maybe 10% of their salary into the 10% from you additional to their salary, and then they would have to take a substantial amount all out of their salary as well. So I don't know how they think this is going to work. Anyway, by the time people would have felt that so-called minimum wage increase, that money is going to be coming right back out. And this is why I was very uncomfortable with the minimum wage increase, not because I don't think people deserve more money. I definitely think people deserve more money, but because of things like this. So, you know, just reason now to just tax that money out. And then, of course, with that increase, there came a rise in the cost of living. And so your increase is still not catching up with the rate of inflation, and the rate of inflation probably increase a little more because of the increase. So what you were doing at $300, you can't do it anymore. So even though you did get an increase, everybody's cost went up, not just the people at the bottom. And that's what we're seeing. So the report added that the required contribution rate to pay all expenditures in the next 6 years is 22.55%. All right, why are we having this conversation? That just NIB alone wants 22.55% of what a person would be making. That's an excessive, almost a quarter of a person's salary going to the government, not your salary, but between you and your employer. Everybody putting in 22.5% of what would be the value of every salary in the country is a lot of money. It's a really, really a lot of money. And I think we need to start rethinking this concept at this point. The report recommended that over the short term, the contribution rate for the pension be increased to 11% between 2019 and 2023. The higher unemployment benefits paid in 2020 due to severe contraction of the GDP because of COVID-19 increases the requirement contributions to 23%. It's insane what they're saying. And so I don't know who did these numbers, and I won't say that I'm an analyst or whatever like that, but just from my comment, kind of broadly aware of some of this financial stuff, these models don't seem to be taking into consideration that, you know, if you improve unemployment, like they have said that they've done, so it's down to 8.8%, that you would have more people paying in, and therefore you would not have to have these type of increases. So I really would like to see the analysis on this, because in my mind, if you increase the amount of people working and they're making more money, then that should balance out the need for such excessive increases. But I'm not seeing that rationale. It just seems like a very simplistic model of saying we need this amount of money, so therefore we need to tax them that amount. So the article goes on to talk about that the chairman said an increase in the contribution rate is the only serious way to bring balance to the monies coming into the fund and the monies being spent. No talk about, you know, finding other streams of revenue or using the money in other increase the pension fund. Nothing. And in a very long run, the question is, can we increase the number of contributions to the fund? But of course, you know, that means growing the population of the Bahamas in a substantial way. So you'd have the contributors to offset what appears to be an ever-increasing pension due to payments simply just living longer. They could also do what they were doing before with the nomadic residents and allowing to pay a simple tax as well over here. There's so many other streams of revenue that they could look at. We talked about multinational companies being taxed. Somehow that conversation became we should also be taxing Bahamians. I don't understand that. But that would probably be a really amazing source of income if we looked into that as well. So they say you're living longer, and so therefore they can't afford it. So I think they need to relook at the plan and what they may need to do. It goes on to talk that if they address it now and they can get started, the increase could be at a lower rate. If it's not addressed, let's say in a year, say 2004, which it is going to be, then they're looking at a more significant number. However, the prime minister said it wasn't going to be an increase. And now we know this 1.5% is kind of trickled over to possibly next year. So they really want this rise, and they've been talking about recommendations of increasing NIB since 2003. And they talked about this factor being a watershed moment. Knowing that this was a problem from 2003, we've had multiple leadership changes that have still caused us to be here where we are. And so I would think that there needs to be a really deep dive into this and what does this mean for the Bahamian people. Are you as a surviving or are you thriving in the Bahamas? What does this look like? You know, we're going to take a look as well as what does it mean to be middle class in Bahamas and comparing that to what we know about the United States. And how are you fitting into the reality of all of this? Do you think that as a country we can afford to be asking for more money from the Bahamian citizens? Is this increase in the cost of living really affecting Bahamians in the way that I feel like it's affecting Bahamians? Or do you feel like, you know, we're just going to go with the flow and make it happen? It's not a big deal. You know, how do you feel about that? And do you think that as a country, we're going in the right direction according to this? So we have a lot of mixed messages. We say we're doing better, but we need more money for taxes. Should we be giving more money to our leaders? Should they make do? Should they find other streams of revenue? And is the average Bahamian feeling what is supposed to be all these improvements or increases? You know, are we really feeling it? And are we really getting the benefits of all these taxes? Are you interested in being taxed more? I'm not interested in being taxed more. I think it's very difficult to live in this country, and it's very difficult to move from lower economics into middle class, and even harder to go from middle class into this higher economic echelon. And I found some statistics that was looking at the cost of living for family in the Bahamas. And it's really, really interesting. So a lot of these statistics come from, you know, I guess people looking from the outside in. And the number, I guess, is, I found a bunch of different stuff, but the numbers are kind of saying, you know, that for a family of four without rent, the things that are quoted on the sites, I guess they're American sites or international sites, is a single family, if you're not paying any rent, needs $5,000 a month. And as a single person without rent, they're talking about $1,400 a month, and it's just not paying rent. This is what they're estimating it costs to just kind of live and survive in the Bahamas. And on average, quotes that I saw is that the cost of living in the Bahamas on average is 26.3% higher than in the United States. So we do have lower payment brackets than the United States. Of course, we don't have direct income tax in that kind of way, but we living overall is 26.3% higher. Although rent is a little cheaper here, 12% lower than in the United States, 26.3% higher just to kind of live and go through your daily life and expenditure in this country. So what does that really mean? I know that there are a lot of Bahamians who are, in fact, leaving the country and going to other countries to live, including America. A lot of these people have children that are living in America, and they're simply just not coming back. So we're kind of losing the older persons who may be, you know, middle class or upper middle class in terms of economics, so have gotten to a comfortable place in their life, and they are receiving their pensions and moving abroad. And so a lot of that money is not even staying in the country. A lot of that money is out of the country. If you want to join in, 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. Is the cost of living going up too much? Are Bahamians able to survive this? And do you consider the government considering additional taxes an issue? We've got different websites saying that Bahamians are making typically between $32,000 and $52,000 a year. You know, I'm sure that's skewed a lot by different things, but those are the type of numbers that we are kind of seeing if you were just to ask online about that type of thing. And so the other thing that I saw was a breakdown of this online, and this was a survey, a salary survey that's online, the average salary. And they basically poll people in the country. And this poll had about 241 people. And that's what they had. They had that the average salary was $52,251. And the most typical salary was $32,000. Now, I'm not sure if these are expats or people living here or whatever, or just Bahamians, but this is what I saw. And I kind of saw similar on other websites, okay? And they were saying in NASA, the average was about $48,686. Unemployment rate was a lot higher, about 13%, and I think that's down to like 8.8% now. But this is what they say. The average salary is $52,251, the most typical earning being about $32,000. And that was based on the 241 people they surveyed. Average men made more, $57,307. And women, on average, $47,705. The highest paid careers were in aviation and shipping, which averaged about $120,000. And archaeology and history, I don't know who these people are, they did $105,113. So... and based on education, the highest salaries received with people with doctorate's degree were around $75,709. And the second most paid level is a master's degree, about $65,108. Different experiences affect earnings as well. So I'm thinking a lot of these are people that they polled were professionals. And that this is probably why. So the difference experiences of, affect earning as well. People between the ages of 16 and 20 years old, 20 years received a salary of about $71,608. Employees with 20 plus years of experience actually were getting less money, $66,908. And so I looked at the distribution of this across the board. And out of the people they surveyed, about 21 of those people were making between $10,000 and $15,000, about 8.7%. Between $15,000 and $20,000 was about 11 people, which was about 4.5%. $20,000 to $24,000 is one of the bigger groups, and probably that was about 9.54 or 23 people. Between 25 and 30,000 was about 4.5%. The most typical salary was the 30 to 35,000 bracket, which was about 11.6% of the people who participated in the study. And then it kind of goes on. Another big grouping was 50 to 55,000, and that was about 8.7%. And then it's kind of like about 3% in the other groups. It kind of jumps up a little bit again in the bracket of 100 to 104,000, about 5.5% of people. And then, of course, it gets slimmer in these categories making over $100,000. There was a little group of people that were making about 125,000, about 2.5%. And then it just kind of really fizzles out after about $190,000. So I wouldn't say that's the average, but if you look on the internet, you will find that a lot of people are making kind of in that range of about $50,000, according to the internet. Information that I saw on the Bahamas, I think it was more something that was done here, PAHO or one of those or something. There was a quite different arrangement in terms of the cost and the cost of living, but there it was. So we'll talk a little bit more about like the middle class and what does that mean for healthcare. But we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back on the Doctor's Inn after just a moment.
Always on the go? Miss the show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Or by intro. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
The new Guardian Radio app is here. Listen live to all our Guardian Radio shows and live video stream select programs in our studio. Get information about Guardian Radio shows and our hosts. Send messages, including text, email, and even call. All from our amazing new Guardian Radio app. Download it free today in your app store for your Apple or your Android device. The all-new and improved Guardian Radio app.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back to the Doctor's Inn with me, Dr. Dinothra Archer Cartwright. We're here on Guardian Radio 96.9 live, and you can join us 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. Our phone lines are open, and we're talking about health and wealth and the increase of the cost of living. Yes, I'm sure everyone's feeling an increase in the cost of living. Maybe you're not. And if you're okay with the cost of things going up, is it affecting you and your family? So we're talking about that. We have another article that we want to review about by Dr. Thomas, MD. And the article is talking about health and wellness, health and wealth, per se. And they talk about the abundance of proof that money does buy better health care, better health, and a longer life. On the other hand, good health is linked to the ability to create wealth as well. Thus, there's a strong link between between several health indicators over a person's lifespan and your income, right? And so by keeping our incomes down and not having access to our money, you know, is it affecting our health in so many different ways, as we discussed tonight? And so multiple studies have shown that wealthier people live longer, have less chronic disease, and maintain a higher level well into their older age, you know, and just live longer. Reduced death rates, longer life expectancy, lower risk of lifestyle conditions modified by income such as obesity, smoking, hypertension, asthma, and concomitant benefits of having higher disposable income. So better living conditions are available for the wealthy. Couple that with better preventative and therapeutic health care. It's a really, really serious thing because we realize that the poor, their life and their health is impacted by their lack of resources. So disability or chronic ill health results from such conditioning and may cause a person to have lots of problems through their life. The effects of poor healthcare due to poverty and social inequalities may extend across generations to affect the unborn. For instance, a lack of vaccinations, unborn prone to other effects that might, and we see that in really extreme poverty. And so we really have to look at that, as well as maternal deaths, lack of access to affordable quality healthcare, increased spending of healthcare means less money for other expenses. So even if you have the money for healthcare, you may have to take that from other places, which reduces your savings. And then, of course, you also have to keep money for unprecedented problems in health and other emergencies. So poor health also reduces productivity and reduces earning capacity, impacts learning, and reduces emotional well-being. Among high-income countries such as America, men and women live as high as 76 to 81 years old, and they have the highest rates. Since they have the highest rates of injury and disease globally, they're demanding. Interestingly, despite having high incomes, Americans have high rates of homicides, vehicle accidents, sexually transmitted disease, obesity, and other problems, drug-related issues. So it's not perfect because of money, but money does provide the access to a lot of the healthcare things you need. So, access sometimes to more bad food is also a problem as well. So the inequalities that are bred within healthcare is a problematic thing, and it affects the country at large and affects how we all interact with each other and affects all of our healthcare decisions in the future, depending on our resources. So we have to look at those health inequalities as we make decisions. So ill health breeds economic issues. Of the literature shows that ill health causes a direct impact on the ability to work and earn, and for the workers and related family to act as consumers and participate in leisure activities. So if people are healthy, they can, you know, they can do more leisure activities. And if they have the money to do it, you know, all of this goes hand in hand, almost like a cycle in terms of health and well-being together. So indirect costs are also high, which reduce work productivity, such as not being able to come to work, being absent, having to take an early retirement, or not being employed at all due to illness and debilitating conditions. And we have people who have such poor health that they can't work, and they do need to have support from the system, and that money needs to be there for people. But how do we deal with that on a level where an illustration of that was the 40% cost of sustaining a person with multiple sclerosis that becomes simply a loss of productivity. So the cost of unhealthiness really impacts our productivity and being able to work and create an economy that is sustainable. And it's stressful. So, you know, not having in a country like the Bahamas the money to sustain yourself when things are very costly, it also increases stress and reduces your life expectancy and affects your overall health. And studies show that people in more egalitarian societies live longer, experience less violence, and have lower rates of obesity and teen pregnancy, and are less likely to illicit drugs, enjoy better mental health than their counterparts in countries with a wide divide between the rich and the poor. It used to be quite clear. I'm not sure what's going on in the United States right now. They are kind of in a weird place. And maybe it's because so many people are, you know, out of poverty that they've created problems of their own. So stress is a powerful weapon, and that really affects both the rich and the poor. But you can see how that added economic stress can lead to substantial health issues and impact your health or the way that you live in society, in the world, and in terms of health. And it's just stressful, you know. Like they say, if something was to happen, most people don't have even the money in the bank to do it. And so, so in addition to the physical aspects of poverty, even the rich suffer from chronic, you know, issues, and that has to be dealt with. But it's having the resources to do it. And that is one of, and it came up as we looked at that. We talked a little bit about how that affects children concerning health in society, and how it can lead to problems later in their life related to both their health and their economic growth. And we have to start looking at ways to deal with that. So policies to reduce inequalities are health and wealth producing policies. And they must be entrenched in commercial interests that markets food and products that foster ill health must be fought and removed from decision-making areas at the top. And this has to happen around the world. So making food that is nutritious as reasonable as possible, bringing down the cost of what it needs to be healthy. It should be cheaper to eat healthy than it is to eat unhealthy. And I've always found it strange that products that are processed or have had a lot of processing and additives and, you know, all this bioengineered food is somehow cheaper than just, you know, growing the food that's going to be healthy and good for us. Foods are creating problems for us, possibly in the long run. You know, there's large discussions on how to manipulate the food that goes into our body. And somehow it seems to be extremely expensive to get the food that's just grown without all of this stuff. So we need to find a way of investing in agriculture and farming in a way that it's more sustainable to do things in a organic, non-GMO environment, non-engineered environment, and decrease the processing of food, which is amazing. You're taking more steps, but it's costing less to bring it to the public. I've always felt that there was something really wrong there. And so, you know, we as a country, we need to find our way out of that. We can't depend on the rest of the world to determine, because as you can see, the cost of our food is really relying on what's happening globally. And that's why we are feeling the cost of the increase of living so substantially, being a country that has to import a lot. So all of these policies are all intertwined with each other, and we have to take a multi-pronged interventional approach, you know, and take steps to health and wealth in this manner. And we have to do that because we have people who need healthcare, and, you know, there are steps to provide that. But also, we need to allow people to not just survive in this country, but to thrive, to put money back into this economy, and so that it is sustainable, so it's all together. So people should take charge of their health as far as possible in terms of maintenance, regular checkups, building good habits, because it's costly to be ill. It's really, really costly to be ill. Spend my money on prevention. I would rather spend it up ahead on good food than anything else. So that's why we need to leave some money in the pocket of Bahamians, and we have to look at this inflation problem and kind of figure out what to do, because we have two problems. You have people not being able to maintain themselves and people not being able to manage themselves because of the cost of living. All right. And every time we lose someone to a chronic illness, that is taking, you know, someone healthy out of the community, out of the workforce. And it all goes hand in hand. It all goes hand in hand. So longer lifespan implies that we need to build enough capital in your lifetime, because as you can see, we have the NIB system, which is actually saying out loud that because people are living longer, so what do you do? Maybe we're at the point where you can allow people to invest their money the way that they like and make NIB optional, and then you won't have this problem, or maybe you'll have another problem. But I think to just kind of only tax, and look for more money whilst you're not doing sufficiently with the money you have, that system should have a way of growing its income through its investments. And if those investments aren't working out, then they need to take another look at it, because maybe I can take my money and invest it better somewhere else. So I think most people are paying at least $100 a month is going out into that per person, per working class person, maybe even more. And so perhaps if that person was saving that $100 or putting that into another area, they may be of a pension or otherwise. So public attitudes to health and wealth are super important. And public knowledge is what drives entities. So that's why I like to do these informative talks, because if we the people are informed and we know what we need and we want, then we can ask our leaders for the same thing. So public attitudes drive public behavior. Behavior is one area that psychologists can help change, and their skills can be used to harness and drive healthy and productive behavior. The situation that favors the creation and economic disparities can be connected only by advancing wealth to invest among those who have been disadvantaged by all factors and allow them to move forward by providing opportunities in education, banking, police, the justice system, housing, including their inputs while framing policies. And so into all of this, and we have a golden opportunity to educate our next generation. That means improving the educational system. That's why I talk about education quite a bit, because what we want to see in 20 years, we need to start developing that now. And so not only do we need to teach our people more about finances and how to build wealth, and the first step is getting out of high school, people, getting out of high school. We talked about the three things that to get out of poverty: getting out of high school, not having any children out of wedlock before the age of 21, and having a full-time job. You know, those three things are going to be the foundation of building wealth and being able to get at least to a status of middle class. If you want to get beyond that, then you may need a college degree or have really great business savvy and come up with a really amazing company. And so put in place, education needs to continue. But at the end of the day, we all are affected by the cost of living in this country. We have a caller. Sorry, caller. Are you on the air? Caller, you still there?
All right, good evening, Dr. Anjo.
Okay, you got the last minute.
Yeah, I wanted to get this in. You know, I'm vexed, okay? By the way, I'll send you a picture of your new... I just signed up my children. I think they picked... I signed them under you, right?
Okay.
My 11-month-old son and my 7-year-old daughter. So you'll be seeing them, but I was trying to get a bite while I was just talking, but the thing is, there's a healthcare needs policing, and it needs input from patients like me, who are kind of well-read and know what's going on. Like, say, I'm vexed. You see the TERP, right? The TERP.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know about two TERPs, right, Dr. D?
Yeah, you mentioned that. Yeah.
Since we start, and then see, I'm a living example of how invasive it really is, and so...
Yeah.
For them to still be promoting innovations like Eurolift and Resume and all these different things and delays and all that, you know what I mean? It's really disheartening for me. In other words, the TERP is it makes you, you're unable, it makes you less capable of making babies, right? So All of this is a hidden global agenda. And also, not to talk about the side effects versus, I mean, all right, the larger the prostate is, the BPH symptoms, it really is worse during the surgery. You lose more blood. So
yeah, I've seen it. It was one of the first surgeries that I saw as a doctor.
Yeah, doctor, you stopped my surgery, doctor. So what I'm saying is...
And it was horrible.
Yeah, doctor, you stopped my surgery. So a laser would have been more a step they should move towards, the seal of the blood vessels. And I wouldn't even like to tell you how long I was bleeding intermittently, right? So, you know, from a patient's perspective and liaising with doctors and stuff like that, there's so many different things we need to discuss, but the thing, because you know, I know what's going on, they should have, that really is outdated. You know, a surgery like that being on for like 120 years, going on 130 years, they really, and they call it the gold standard. So that's a farce, and I'm living it, and it's just retrograde ejaculation. I knew about it for years, you know. But it is what it is, Dr. D. And so with healthcare, the poor people have no choice. So what I wanted to share was that there's a subliminal or an inconspicuous, insidious message or agenda to get rid of the poor because you don't deserve health care. And so what you do is now, what most people are not mindful of, you know, this is what it is. The price of health care and the affordability of health care is really a death sentence for some people. And then we hate to believe that's what it really is. That's what it really is. I mean, but they, yet still they're saying they're moving towards egalitarianism, getting rid of poverty with sustainable development goals. You know, Dr. D,
yeah,
I'm so vexed
when
I hear these fools on the radio talking about Dr. D. These people have no idea what they're talking about. They
yes,
need
sir.
To read a book.
Yeah.
Oh, God, Dr. D. Why these educated people come on the radio with these global impositions and they know nothing about it? The ladies on the radio couldn't even answer questions about the United Nations. And, bless them.
Yeah,
bless them.
We got to go 52. I'm sorry I got the call a little late. I was just kind of talking. But, yes, thank you very much. We're going to wrap it up. Thank you all for watching The Doctor's In with me, Dr. D. But, yes, just on his point, there's a lot of stuff that's going on, but we need to make this cost effective, and I think there's strategies to do that if we really invest the money that we are putting into our government and use those resources correctly. So I want you guys to have a good night. Please try to be stress-free, and you know, we'll talk more about how do we get the money to make our lives better in another show. So thank you and good night. We'll talk to you next week, Tuesday, with The Doctor's In, me, Dr. D. Archer. Good night.